and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's show, we are talking HR issues for small business with Anne Close of Close HR Connections. And Anne is a certified professional in human resources, or a PHR, and she's also a member of the Society for Human Resources. Close HR Connections is an HR consulting firm focused on growth, growing startups, and small businesses that need fractional HR support. Anne has over 20 years of HR experience as an HR generalist, working in startups, tech firms, corporate headquarters, and small local businesses. Anne is very experienced in developing an HR game plan for businesses, which includes defensive, offensive, and special team strategies that work in conjunction with your business goals. Anne is an active member and volunteer with Raleigh Wake Human Resources Management Association and the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. She also is a volunteer leader at Hope Community Church. Anne's website is closehrconnections.com. Anne, thanks for being back on the show today.
Thank you for having me back. This is nice. I think there's actually a little bit of sun coming out before the rain comes in, so we'll be able to enjoy that this morning.
Promises, promises, promises. So, yeah, this cloudy weather's getting to me. But let's talk about the environment of small business today. We have more and more regulations, more and more HR issues, everything from overtime compensation, classifying employees, employee manuals, all these things inundating the small business. How do we help them get a handle on those, and where do they start to address those issues?
Well, that's a good question, because there are a lot of issues. There's more and more regulations, like you said, that are coming out. And for a small business owner who's already wearing several hats, he's not only the business owner, but he's usually in charge of sales and marketing.
The technical expert. I mean, everything business, right?
Exactly. So in addition to all those other hats, now they have to worry about the HR hat and making sure that they're compliant for what whatever regulations fit their size of the business. So it's a huge project, and it's an ongoing project, but you just got to take it one step at a time and address things as they come up, and as much as you can, try to be proactive, ask questions, go to a free workshop that maybe Wake Tech or Durham Tech or somebody puts on, or if there's something webinar, but they obviously don't have the cash flow and the size to really support an HR person in-house. Which would be the best of all worlds. But there are options out there as fractional people and resources that can come and help a small business owner. And they're in lots of different forms and fashions. Myself, I work with a lot of small businesses about the size from 5 to 50 employees.
Right.
The time where they're starting to potentially add benefits, and they're growing, and they're trying to focus on all those other hats, and they just need some help taking care of their people, because obviously the people is what's going to grow the business.
Right.
Their people are the, you know, the first line of folks that their customers see, their vendors work with, so they want to make sure they're doing the right things. So definitely, I'm seeing some of my clients in particular where they are starting to feel better about the economy and how things are going, and they're starting to add folks, which is awesome, because the last several years, unfortunately, I've helped lay off or terminate a lot of people, which is not one of my favorite things. But we've been hiring people the last probably 60, 90 days, 120 days, which is very exciting, but very overwhelming for a small business, because when you have even just one new person come in, it changes the mix of the environment. Now you're delegating things that you used to do to someone new, and they don't
do it exactly. Supposed to be, right?
Yeah, they don't do it exactly the way you did, but you know you need to work with them. But definitely, one of the things to think about as small business is when you look for that first person, you know, you're going to get overwhelmed with resumes.
But yeah, I've seen people post and get thousands of resumes when they post one job.
One job. That's exactly right. The best way to find somebody is referrals. Ask your clients, ask your vendors, ask your employees. They know people that are looking for
jobs.
Call
your competitors. Just kidding, people.
Yeah, don't disregard that comment. But ask for referrals, because those folks know your business and they know the type of people you're looking for. And especially your employees, they're going to refer somebody that they enjoy working with. So that kind of makes it a little bit easier. But as you're going through resumes, whether it's 10 or 100, you want to come up with like three or four core things, skill set wise, for the position that are must haves. And when you weed through the resumes, anything that doesn't match that, you push it aside. And that would be pretty much your no category. If, say, somebody has 3 out of 4, then put them in a maybe. And if they have 4 out of 4, that's the ones you want to start with, because that pile will be smaller.
And the caution, when we take somebody that's a referral, we still have to do our background checks on them. We have to do all of those types of things. And we also have to consider that if there's a relationship dynamic there, and are they the right person, the right role, the right skill sets. It's great if they're good to work with, but they may not be qualified for the position.
Exactly. You should not only hire people that are qualified, because as you want to be careful of discrimination. As long as you're hiring for a skill set, then that minimizes the risk that you're going to have somebody, you know, say something like that, or hire someone that's not going to be a good fit for the position.
How important do you think it is to sit down formally and put on a piece of paper the skills and the qualifications and the tasks that are going to be, who they're going to report to, what the expectations and outcomes are, and those kind of things?
That's critical. It's critical to develop basically a job description. What are the essential functions? What are the non-essential functions? What are the skill sets for that? What are some of the, you know, experience and knowledge that you want that person to have? And develop a job description, because you want to use that job description in the interview process when you're down to the 1 or 2 people that you're talking to. And you want to give that job description to them and ask them if there's anything in there they have questions about or that they can't perform. And if somebody, you know, says, you know, hey, I can't do this, then that gives you information that you can help make a better decision, whereas you can't ask any medical questions, of course.
Right.
So when you have the physical requirements of the position in there, then you're allowing somebody to basically say, you know, this is probably not a good fit for me, and that relieves a lot of stress on your side trying to decide whether that person may or may not be qualified.
Well, and we're talking about making sure that we're making this transition. We're going to hand something off to somebody that they share the values of the company too, right? That they're going to be able to buy into the goals, that they're going to be able to follow those rules. Because I see a lot of small businesses bring somebody in and that person wants to immediately change everything, right? They know better. And that dynamic can be really challenging to manage.
Yes, that does happen on a frequent basis. Culture is very important. That's something that you want to definitely hire for. Because when it comes down to it, if somebody has the same values and the same worth ethic that you do, that's not something that you normally can teach somebody.
Right.
But if there's a missing skill set, most of the time you can bring that person up to speed and teach them that skill set. So then you have an awesome employee that not only fits the values of your company, but also can perform the job. So when it comes down to it, culture is definitely something that which should be the number one thing you're looking for, and the skill set would be number two.
Well, let's talk a little bit about when we're trying to create a job position and that job description. What I frequently see with the small businesses I go into is they'll make somebody a salaried employee thinking that I don't have to pay them overtime because I'm paying them a salary. Let's talk about that exempt, non-exempt, the classification of a regular full-time employee, all of those kind of things. Kind of define those for the listeners.
Sure. Many times folks get confused that salaried and hourly are the definitions that they should go by, but you're right. It's exempt and non-exempt. The exempt folks are going to be those that have a professional degree. They're managing people. They have budget responsibilities. They can make decisions on their own.
They can hire and fire.
Hire and fire employees. They do performance reviews. They're definitely in a position where they would be salaried and they would work 40 hours a week or more. They have those kinds of responsibilities.
Meaning they don't have to be paid overtime.
Correct. That they would not be eligible for overtime. Those other folks that are performing more task-oriented type roles and or even some professional level, but they still don't, they're not supervising, they're not hiring and firing, they don't have a budget to worry about, then those would be considered non-exempt employees. And with non-exempt employees, most of the time you would pay them hourly. But there are occasions where if you are certain that they will be working 40 hours a week, you can set them up on a salary with their hourly rate times 40.
Right.
But if they work half an hour, 2 hours, 10 hours over 40, anything above 40 would then have to be paid at overtime, which is 1.5 times their salary. So anybody non-exempt, regardless of how you're paying them, hourly or salaried, they are eligible for overtime, and you are responsible to pay that. You can't do comp time. You can't.
That was my next question. I get hundreds of emails on this question. Well, my employer wants to give me comp time. Well, within a specific work week, you could adjust the schedule to keep it into 40. But when it gets beyond that, comp time is not available for private sector employers.
That's
the
correct.
Government can do it. Certain UAW or union shops under agreement can do it. But for the majority of employers, comp time does not exist.
That's right. Comp time does not exist. The only time that you would use comp time would be on occasion if you had an exempt employee that maybe they spent 80 hours for 3 or 4 weeks knocking out a project and you wanted to do something for them. You could do something like comp time, but it definitely not for non-exempt people. You have to pay them.
And in that case, it's really not comp time because salaried employees are paid by hours or weeks or whatever as a convenience.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever hours they work or don't work really doesn't come into play as long as they're meeting the minimums and doing and fulfilling their jobs.
Exactly. If they work 1 hour and get sick and go home, you don't dock them seven
right.
hours. You have to pay them for the whole day. And likewise, on the flip side, which is usually more often than not, when they work 45, 50, 60 hours, you're not paying them overtime. So it's supposed to
even out
on both sides, but it's usually heavier on the side where they're working more.
So when we're trying to find the right composition of full-time, part-time, all of these different types of categories, exempt and non-exempt, is it good to sit down and just take all of our employees, the roles that need to be fulfilled, make formal job descriptions, even for those that have been with us for a while, and then analyze where we stand?
That's an excellent way to approach it. I'm a huge sports fan. Go Heels. So I use offense, defense, and special teams. And one thing you do in the sports world for sure, but even in a company, is put down what positions do you have, what skill sets go along with them. Leave the names out because
right.
then things
Job
get
Job titles
messy.
Are great.
Job titles are great. Then go through and see, are there holes? Are there things that maybe cross-training would take care of? Is it a brand new a product line that you've got going and you're going to need new folks that have a different skill set than what you have, but put together basically lay out your roster and see where the holes are. And then you're going to go basically find those people, whether it's hiring through a posting, whether it's word of mouth and asking for referrals, whether maybe you touch base with, high school or a college and look for an intern, part-time people, flex, any kind of flex time that you have that you can, bring somebody in or have them, work in a limited capacity so that you don't always have to hire full-time people.
So two topics that are kind of there that kind of give rise to this, Obamacare and when that kicks in and those kind of requirements. And then you mentioned interns. So I kind of want to cover both topics, but let's start with the interns. A lot of companies bring in an intern from a high school or college and don't want to pay them. And that's just not what the IRS says.
I was going to say, those days are long gone. You definitely need to be paying them minimum wage for the hours that they work. There's only rare occasions where it's actually part of the curriculum of the class. But the stringent requirements are such that most of the time you're not going to meet those. So you definitely need to be paying interns, regardless if they're high school, college, working 5 hours or working 40 hours.
Right. And so when we see clients trying to balance their staff and the needs of their customers, and then how do they develop a strategy that says, okay, I don't want to get into the Obamacare level, right? But I need to have more employees. Do we look at contract workers and getting them through a formal temp agency or seasonal agency? How does that come into play? And how do we just manage when we have demands up and demands down, that those ebbs and flows?
Okay. There's a lot of ways to attack that. And definitely that is a very big thing on the minds of small business owners because they're struggling to provide benefits to who they have currently. But there's several ways you can do that. You can look at part-time, but you need to have part-time people that are working like 20 to 25 hours. If you're scheduling them for 28, they're going to probably end up working 29 or more. And when you get audited, not if, when you get audited, they're going to make you flip those people because they're riding too close to the line. So you need to, you can look for 20 to 25 hour type people. You can go through temp agencies, and that way the burden's on them. Again, you can use an intern for if it's just a short period of time. But, you know, at some point you need to look at, you know, what can you provide for your full-time employees? Where is the line going to be? And you definitely don't want to be, you know, walking it too close, because part-times will all add together as full-time equivalents, and most of the time that's going to push you over if you're trying to ride the line.
Well, and that's kind of – I frequently walk into clients, and they're using 1099 people and thinking, well, they're not an employee, they're a contractor. Let's talk about the IRS rules for defining an employee and a true 1099 contractor that's not going to get us in trouble in that audit.
That's a question that comes up all the time with prospects, clients, just contacts that I meet, is that they think that they can just change somebody to a contractor and they're okay. The IRS is really cracking down on that, and now they're looking for EIN numbers for contractors, not just their Social Security number. They need to be marketing their skill set to the public. They can't just be working for you.
More than one customer, right?
They need to have more than one customer. You can't be controlling their times, and you know, they have to be at meetings. They're wearing your shirts. They're driving your trucks.
They have a business card with their name.
Yes, they need a business card with their entity on there in order to truly be a contractor. So unless they're working for somebody else and you're not, you know, completely dictating, you know, for the most part, what they're doing, and if they don't have an EIN number and they don't have a website and a business card, you definitely are going to be told that those are employees, and they're going to flip back on your payroll, and, you know, there's an opportunity there for the IRS to charge you for back payroll taxes and then fines and penalties.
And tax and avoidance because you didn't do your
exactly.
payroll.
Exactly. And then they're going to go after the person that was claiming to be a contractor because they know that there's an opportunity there that potentially they haven't claimed everything that they were supposed to. So it just gets really messy. So just avoid that. If they're working only for you, then they're either an employee or you need to cut their hours so they can go find another employer as well.
Well, and the other thing is, once an employee, always an employee, as far as the, you know, we used to see people retire out, come back as a contractor, and the IRS is cracking down on that too, right?
They certainly are. I know there's some businesses in the park that used to do that, had a reputation of doing that quite often, and yes, the IRS said, no, we're not going to let that happen. That's dollars that we're missing, and obviously they are in the red in their budget, so they're looking for revenue, and that's a great way to find it.
Well, and when we're looking at this, and we have to be conscious, too, that, say, we're getting tight on money, and we're not sure we're going to make payroll or whatever, and I've seen employers tell them, well, just don't cut the checks. The checks have to get cut on time and issued, and if they bounce, that's a whole different question.
That's a big mess,
but
yes.
You have to make the payroll.
You have to make the payroll. You have to pay your payroll taxes, or they will come get you. The IRS is not somebody that you want to mess with.
And the liability for payroll taxes and failure to pay can also be personal liability mm-hmm. for the business owner or the preparer of the payroll.
That's correct.
And so we can't just say, well, we didn't have the money, so we didn't do it.
Right.
You've got to take the proper steps to do that.
And to be a responsible employer and business person, you should, you know, hopefully never get to that point. Things happen. Life happens sometimes, but your responsibility is to cut those payroll checks and to payroll those payroll taxes and find the money, whether, I don't know where, but find it.
Well, and when we're sitting down as business owners with HR, we're planning these strategies, we have to be aware of keeping enough payroll and tax money and stuff in the bank. At what point can we bring someone in to help us sit down and say, okay, we realize our business is not at this point. When's the best time to make that effort? As much as we hate to do it, but maybe we need to, like St. Augustine's College is doing, furlough employees periodically for a week or 2 weeks or cut hours or anything that's like that.
If your cash flow is running really, really tight, I would encourage you to look at it on a weekly or biweekly basis at a minimum, maybe a monthly basis at most, and be as proactive as possible. And if you see that that's going to happen, you need to start making decisions sooner than later. The worst thing to do in the world is just abruptly do something, because most of the time you're making a decision out of panic and fear versus a truly wise business decision for the circumstances that you're in.
One of the things I see with businesses that have been struggling with this, they don't pay the employees and they put it down under deferred compensation. So let's talk about what true deferred compensation is and when it's allowed, how it's treated, and those kind of things.
Usually deferred compensation is more for, you know, our executives. Oftentimes they'll get a base salary, and then there's a deferred piece of that compensation that is more performance-based or performance-based.
Go ahead. It's the joys of live radio, and inevitably you will get, especially with this type of weather and stuff. So, but what happens is, especially I see it in the tech startups and those kind of things, that we're challenged to, we don't have cash flow. We're trying to raise funds. We're trying to pay everybody and those kind of things. And it's like, just like, well, I'll pay them later and I want to put it on the books. And you see this entry growing and growing and growing. And the other thing is, the payroll taxes for that accrued liability are not getting paid. And so that gives us huge implications on what we need to address, how to do it. And we can't just do things because we think it'll, we can fix it later, right? Because the IRS is government and looking over our shoulder.
The IRS is looking over your shoulder every minute. But yes, you can't, that's not a path that you should choose. You should always be able to make your payroll regardless of what it is. So you should never bring on people before you have the cash flow. If you do, it needs to be some sort of a contract arrangement potentially before they become employees. But that's not that's not going to be a long-term nor necessarily a wise thing to do, because then that, you know, potentially causes other issues.
Right.
So, you know, I would encourage you. I know, you know, it seems like it's, you know, great. Just add a bunch of people and we'll pay them later. The IRS doesn't look at things that way. When you bring somebody on, they should start getting paid at that point, and you should start paying their payroll taxes at that point as well. And if you can't, then you need to reconsider bringing on that person at that point in time and bring them on when you have raised the capital or you have, you know, landed that first client and you have some cash flow.
Well, and what about trial periods, you know, those kind of things that people, I've seen people, one company I went in and was doing some compliance things with, I looked in and they had this person that still said they were on probationary period. They'd been there like 5 years. They just kept moving this person every 90 days. It didn't work with this person and they liked them, so they kept moving them. But I kept telling, it may be a probationary in that role, but the probationary period is, are you going to keep them employed by the company? They hadn't given them benefits. There were just all of these different things that, you know, they thought, well, I'll keep them on probationary period and I don't have to do this. But after 5 years, there's no way the IRS says that this is still a probationary employee.
Yeah, that's definitely
creative.
Very creative. Typically, a probationary period is no more than 90 days. And it basically coincides also with the Employment Security Commission. If you bring somebody on, you should, 30 days and 60 days, be sitting down with them and giving them feedback on their performance. If there's issues, you should address them sooner than later. Give them an opportunity to understand what is not working and what they need to do to fix that, and a time frame in order to do so. But if you get to that 90-day point and they're not working out, you should be able to make that business decision. And if you do so in that time frame and you let them go, then with the Employment Security Commission, they look at the last 6 full quarters of someone's employment. So if they have not worked for you for a whole quarter, which is 100 days at the Employment Security Commission, then that person's unemployment wages will not come out of your account. So you really want to be conscious of that, and it holds the business accountable. Don't just hire flippantly. Hire somebody intentionally and intentionally give them feedback, because they, you know, oftentimes that employee just doesn't know because you didn't tell them.
Right.
And they can fix something, and then now you have a productive employee that understands what their role is, and they're able to contribute and, you know, really bring, you know, a skill set maybe to the company that's very valuable. Whereas if you don't give them any feedback and they flounder and then you let them go, now you have to go out and hire another person. There's more training when you could have avoided the whole thing. And oftentimes, you know, people will wait. They don't want to confront the situation. So they wait 3, 4, 5 months. And at that point, when you finally let them go, and it's usually
unemployment.
Unemployment now is going to hit your account. So it's much wiser to do the 90-day thing, be very intentional about 30, 60-day review times, and then make the decision between 60 and 90 that yes, they're going to work, or no, they're not, and make the decision and go on, you're going to be a much more productive with your employees, and you're going to have a lot less issues when it comes to hiring and letting folks go and having people in your company that can't do their job because you didn't want to confront the situation.
Well, and that's a good stopping point. When we come back, we'll take a break, but when we come back from the break, let's talk about how do we set up and deal with having to do performance reviews. And I frequently hear from clients, but I really like that person. And I know one of the larger companies I was working with in the area, when I started doing an analysis of their staff, they had over 250 people that were not in a role that was producing anything. But they liked them.
And wow.
So they kept hiring people to do the jobs and liking these people. And so, again, it got down to the criteria that they were hiring for, and did they hire qualified people for the jobs, and then were they willing to manage the performance and get rid of them when they weren't. So coming back from the break, we will pick up on that topic, and you're listening to WCOM FM of Chapel Hill and Carrboro. I'd like to thank our Golden Voice underwriters, The Forest Firm, providing sound legal counsel to new, existing, and growing businesses. Get to know The Forest Firm at their website, www.forestfirm.com. That's www.forestfirm.com. And get to know Focus Resources, your strategic operational and financial business consultant. Visit their website at www.focusresourcesinc.com. That's www.focusresourcesinc.com. We'd also like to thank Harrington Bank, your community bank. Get to know your neighbor at www.bankharrington.com. That's www.bankharrington.com. And finally, we'd like to thank IWP Photography, capturing the important moments of your professional, business, and personal life. With event photography and live event painting, get to know them at their website, www.iwpphotography.com. That's www.iwpphotography.com. Thanks to all of our underwriters. Focus on Business and WCOM FM are proud to support the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. To learn more about the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, visit their website at www.ronaldhousedurham.org. That's www.ronaldhousedurham.org, or give them a call at 919-281-1065. WCOM FM and Focus on Business are proud to support Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina, serving the Triangle. Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina is your community Make-A-Wish. To learn more about what Make-A-Wish is doing, visit their website at www.eastnc.wish.org. That's www.eastnc.wish.org. or give them a call at 1-800-432-WISH. That's 1-800-432-9474. Back, and you're listening to Focus on Business on WCOM FM Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Before the break, we were talking with Ann Close of Close HR Connections, and we were going to talk about how do we address the issues that we're dealing with in small businesses. And so let's kind of pick up on that topic that we left off on, and I'll let you set it up.
Okay. Oftentimes I have clients or prospects, or I just get random email from a business owner that is frustrated with an employee and they're ready to let him go. And so I ask, explain the situation, tell him what's going on. And then oftentimes some of my next questions are, so have you sat down with the employee and explained this to them?
No.
You've been sitting in on my phone calls. And they oftentimes say no, and I said, well, how do you expect them to understand that there is a problem when you haven't addressed it with them? Well, I don't want to sit down, and I don't like the confrontation. And it's like, well,
I'm really not comfortable doing that, right?
Well, yes, that's definitely what comes back. So it's like, well, you know, do you want to fix a situation? And if you do, then you need to do something. So it doesn't have to be hard. You should be giving feedback on a daily basis or a weekly basis, just verbal feedback. You know, hey, that was a great job. You know, hey, I saw you were doing this. I don't think you got this step right. Make sure you don't, you know, skip something, you know, because we want to make sure that we maintain our quality standard. Just give them some feedback. And then if you see the performance or the behavior situation continue, then yes, you do need to sit down and have a conversation and explain it to them. That XYZ is not acceptable. Here's how it's supposed to be done. Here's what I expect you to do to improve this. And we're going to sit down in 2 weeks and go over that. At that point, when you sit down and have that formal conversation, you want to have it documented. And it's basically a written warning.
And have them sign it.
And have them sign it.
Or sign that they're not going to sign it.
That's correct. And you should always have somebody else in the room with you, whether it's your boss or HR. Or a third person, so that if it does come up to a situation where they maybe refuse to sign something or they really think that you're way off base, you have a witness. Otherwise, it's your word against theirs, and that's never a good situation. So when you get back to with them, if they haven't improved it, depending on the issue, you can give them another 2 weeks and say, look, this is what I need. You need to make a decision whether you want to be here or not and whether you're going to apply yourself or try to improve the situation. And then we'll get back together in 2 weeks again. And you just need to know that if it hasn't improved, there's a good chance that the next step is going to be termination. But you need to decide in the next 2 weeks, and you need to observe them, make sure that you don't over-criticize them, but definitely continue to observe them. And when you sit down at the end of the 2 weeks, and it's very clear to them that they have signed this, they signed the second warning as well, that their actions were not acceptable. They know exactly what they were supposed to do, and they had a time frame, and they signed saying that they understood the next step could be termination. So then if they go and, you terminate them and they say that they were wrongfully terminated, during a discovery period, you're going to be asked for documentation as to how you dealt with the employee. Well, if you can show that you had a couple of verbal counsel situations that you just made a note and threw in their file, you had two written warning situations with them, and your last step was termination, then you're showing that you, in good faith, you did as a responsible employer should, is address the situation, give them a chance to improve. They didn't. So as a business, you need people that can do X, Y, and Z, and so therefore you terminated them and you're going to go hire somebody else.
Well, and that's not required necessarily by law, because we can hire and fire in this state anytime. Other states, you have the process and stuff like that. But it's a good business practice because, again, litigation is increasing in the HR realm around the country.
Yes, we are an employment at will state, which is a little bit of a false security. Yes, so you can fire somebody at any time, but if you haven't gone through those, basically what they consider progressive discipline steps, then the Employment Security Commission, the Department of Labor, and anybody else that gets involved is going to say, well, as a responsible employer, best practice is to do these things, and you did not do them, so therefore, you know, you did wrongfully terminate the employee. They didn't know that there was a problem. So, yes, we are an employment at will, only if you have your documentation in a row. We're not employment at will if you're just going to hire out of a situation where you're just angry.
Right.
And or they didn't show up and you just decided that it was too much trouble and you don't have anything documented on their performance at all, then most of the time the employee is going to end up winning that situation.
Right. Well, and what we also have to think about is how do these dynamics impact the other employees that are there and that you're not correcting behavior or whatever. And we also need to be conscious that that dynamic of if this person gets away with it, it sort of starts spreading.
That's exactly right. Your employees are watching what you're doing. Number one, they know that there's an issue. And like you said, oftentimes it's impacting them.
They have to pick up that work.
They're picking up the slack, and they're like, why is the owner not doing anything about this? So they're watching not only from that standpoint, but also if I personally, you know, that person was having an issue, how am I going to be treated?
Right.
Because however you're treating the person that's in the question is probably how you're going to treat me as well. And I don't want to necessarily work for an employer that, you know, is just going to fire me at a whim. I want to know that they are going to come tell me that there's an issue and give me a chance. So, yes, your other employees and your customers and vendors oftentimes know what's going on as well. And if they've complained to you two or three times about an employee and you don't do anything, then
as a customer, I think you don't care if you're not dealing with somebody that's giving me poor service or was rude, and I still have to deal with that person.
Exactly. And if I'm going to have to continue to deal with that person, which is what it seems like based on what's going on, I'm probably going to go find another vendor to do business with that I feel like does do the right thing. So now you're losing business not only from poor performance, but you're losing business from customers deciding that they would like to work with somebody that is going to address issues and that does care.
Well, and let's talk about situations where we see in, I'm going to say, family-owned or small businesses or businesses that have been sort of started up organically, they've been successful, and we see times where favoritism comes into play as to how someone is promoted or how those things are overlooked and dealt with or how one person is coached and given more chances. We have to be really conscious of that because that translates then into discriminatory practices, sometimes even to hostile work environments. Let's talk about those kind of things.
Yeah, and family businesses are always a challenge. You do have, obviously, the dynamics of the relationships and whatnot. More often than not, you do have at least a few other employees that are not related. And you're right, you have to be very careful about discrimination and favoritism because business decisions should be being made, and yes, you might want to bring up, you know, the next generation of leadership, but you need to also be conscious that there are other people that could potentially be in those kind of roles as well and give them the same opportunities. And if the family member is not working out, you do need to address that because them not being called on the carpet about an issue, but yesterday you called one of the employees on the carpet, double standards does not go well for employees that you need to have stay with the company that have a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge. They're not going to stick around very long if they see that they're basically they can work as hard as they want, but they're never going to get an opportunity to move forward.
Right. Well, and there's another aspect of what we deal with the small businesses and things that and family owned. We have multiple owners, and they have a role as an owner, but they also, if they're working in the business, they have a role there. And when one of those owners doesn't perform and it creates performance or deliverable issues for the rest of the organization, the one company I'm thinking about had three partners. One partner was designated. He had to do all the quotes, all of those kind of things, but he was rarely in the office. He didn't get everything flowing through. And even when they would get quotes and responses out, he was the one that was supposed to sign the contracts. That was how everything was decided. And so people were not getting the other criteria and stuff. So in our businesses, especially when we have owner-operators, owner-managers, owner-executives, we have to have that same performance criteria and ability to talk owner-to-owner and say, okay, yes, you're an owner, but that doesn't forgive you performing as an employee on your accountability and your job responsibilities.
That's exactly right. The other owners, they need to all have sort of a pact where they hold each other accountable. And if one person is dropping the ball, the others have to step up. They have to realize that that's going to affect their entire, the investment. It's going to affect the company. It's affecting employees and customers. If one of them backs off, then they need to have provisions where they either take some of those responsibilities off that person's plate,
right,
or hold them accountable just like they would an employee. Otherwise, things are just going to go downhill from there.
Well, and the other dynamic I've been seeing lately is that when we have past owners or past executives working in a company, and the company sets up an established, defined compensation plan of how performance will happen, what kind of bonus programs are, who will and will not get, in health insurance or life insurance, those kind of things. And here comes a past executive or a fractional owner and saying, well, I'm not working, those hours it says I'm unqualified, but even though I'm only working 10 hours, I want the benefits package for the 40-hour full-time person. What kind of implications does that have for the business when you actually violate the terms and conditions of all of the benefits programs you set up, everything from who gets matched and how much and all those kind of things?
That's a very sticky situation, because if you do allow someone that's not eligible to participate, you basically jeopardize the integrity of the plan. And if you get audited, or should say when, or when something comes up and they come in and look at it and they ask you and you've intentionally done this, then the carrier has every right to pull the plan because you haven't abided by the contract that you signed that said you would only provide benefits to 30 hours or more type people. So you cannot make exceptions like that. You need to make up those sorts of things in a compensation plan and maybe give them a stipend or something along those lines.
Pay them more for what?
And exactly.
Then they can get it outside.
But you don't put them on your plan because you are jeopardizing everybody, not just the employees but the other owners. And, benefits are obviously very important to any employee, whether you're an owner or an employee. And so definitely it's not worth jeopardizing the whole for one person. You need to figure out how to take care of that person in a manner that's going to maintain the integrity of the contracts that you have in place.
So when we're sitting there and we're looking at our organization growing, we started as a mom and pop and we were successful and we had 5 employees and they were all related, and now we're at 10 and then we're at 25 and then we're at 50 and the majority of people are not related, and we're trying to go to transition to those defined plans that we get more formalized. How do we manage those conversations and that dynamic? Because making that transition is one of the toughest things businesses can do.
Absolutely. That's where a lot of them fail, unfortunately. And communication is so important. Obviously you're not going to, share maybe, the nitty-gritty details, but you need to really communicate with employees and let them know, hey, we're transitioning, we're looking at this, there might be some changes, we're going to try and do the best we can to take care of everybody the best we can, but there might be some changes, and just continue to keep them in the loop. The worst thing in the world is not knowing what's going on. If you communicate with people and let them have an idea and let them see the vision, share the vision with them and the story. That pulls people in and they want to be a part of something. And they know that you're making some tough decisions, and not all of them might be the best for me, but overall you're trying to look out for everybody. People will be a lot more understanding.
Well, and let's run through some things that I've been getting emails and stuff about in businesses. So one of the things I see is a transition of roles. Someone starts out as, say, an administrative assistant. And over 20 or 30 years, they develop the skill sets and they move in to an executive role. Then they have all these people that saw them start out as the assistant, and they were used to being on the same playing field. And I will say this happens more often with women than it does with men.
It does.
That they want a level playing field. They don't want to acknowledge you're now the boss. And they'll say things like, well, I want more responsibility, and I want to be able to move up and those kind of things. And then you come with them, you get a new job description, you say, okay, I'm happy to help you work towards being a manager or an executive. Here's the things you need to be accountable for. And these will be the things you do. If you want to go this route, you have to let me know. And weeks go by, and they don't let you know they want to do that. And yet, there's still this dynamic of trying to keep things, you know, I'm not going to listen to you as the president of the company or the CEO of the company because you were the same thing as I was. How do we, as an organization and then as women, deal with those kind of people?
That's a good question. Definitely communication, again, is the factor in putting timelines and intentionally getting back with people. If you sit back and wait for them to come to you, oftentimes they won't.
Right.
Again, they don't want to face it and they don't want to confront it. And maybe you don't either as a business owner, but you need to. I mean, it's for the health of the organization. You need to, you know, put timelines and face things along those lines and help them understand that, you know, the business is growing. Here's what your role is going to be. You know, I'm going to need you to be all in. I need you to be accountable. We're a team. You know, this is not about me. It's about what's best for the company, and try to nurture them and bring them along and help them to see that they are important. But, you know, there is a level of expectancy and accountability that they're going to be held to. And if they can't do that, then, you know, ask them, is, you know, what would you, you know, what's the best thing for you at this point? And then let them sort of talk out. Maybe there's something they'd like to do. And oftentimes the conversation comes around to, well, maybe this isn't going to be the best place for me going forward. Now you have a dialogue that you can deal with versus somebody that's trying to be passive aggressive. But communication is definitely key. And part of the biggest part of communication is listening and active listening, not just.
Define what you mean active listening.
Repeat things back to the people so they know, one, that you're listening, and two, it'll help you remember. And then allow them to share what they want to share. Don't just give them 2 seconds and then cut them off or try to finish a sentence for them, but truly ask them open-ended questions about, well, you know, what are you feeling? You know, what are you struggling with? You know, what are some things that you think, you know, might be something? And let them know that you're not going to take what they say carte blanche, I mean, obviously, but you're very interested in their input because they're a valuable member of the team. When people feel valued and listened to, oftentimes it makes the relationship so much better versus pushing them aside or shutting them down and not giving them, you know, a little bit of time and respect to be able to share their feelings.
So let's say we're looking around an organization and we have a lot of people that have been there 20 years or more, and they know the business, and we have somebody come in and they're just there for a few years, but they have the management skills, the personality, those kind of things. How do we help manage that process when people think, well, I've been here 20 years and I should have been promoted to that position versus this, and I've heard this too many times, this 30-year-old kid is going to now and hasn't been here that long, really doesn't know that much. And how do we deal with those generational issues and those kind of dynamics?
For the person that's been hired to come in and be that supervisor, the best advice I can give them is go talk to your people. Get to know them. Let them know that you might not know as much about the business, but you do bring in experience or knowledge from, you know, another area that is going to help them lead the team. But definitely spend some time with each person. Don't just come in and hang out a shingle and think everything is going to be all right, because it's not. You're coming into their business, and like you said, they have lots of experience. You might not have near as many years experience, but you have another skill set, and they don't necessarily recognize the new skill set that's being brought in by you. But getting to know your people, spending some time with them, giving them an opportunity to get to know you as well, can go miles and miles for you as far as building your team.
Now, one of the other things I've been seeing lately is this trying to transition to people being self-managed, right? And so it's almost like a contract. I give you these 10 things you need to get done in this 6 weeks and come back and talk to me later, right? And how do we manage these new dynamics of how people want to manage remote teams, you know, virtual teams, and then on-site where there's fewer people in the chain, and so the CEO is giving something to, normally he would have given it to a vice president, he's giving it to a frontline manager and expecting them to take off and run with it. How does the frontline manager address that, and how does the CEO or business owner deal with that?
If that's a situation, then you definitely need to throw out how you used to do things and need to step back and sit down with that new frontline person that you're going to be dealing directly with and find out how's the best way to move information, share business goals, share, you know, new changes in the business, and figure out the best way to communicate, because it is going to be very different. And both parties can work together, but definitely having a conversation to understand, okay, here's the expectations and here's what we used to do, and this isn't going to work, so we need to figure out the best way to work together. And the frontline managers are going to obviously have to be more accountable, and then the CEO is going to have to be a little bit more understanding that he needs to bring it down from the 30,000-foot level to where the boots hit the ground, the implementation level, and there's a big difference between the two. So you're going to have to intentionally ratchet down the conversation so that it's in a manner that people can understand what it is that the expectation really is.
So one of the transitions I'm seeing with different organizations is they're growing and they have these positions, but they forget the skill sets of the people that are already there, and they forget that they may volunteer with, you know, an HR association, or they might be getting other skill sets and experience outside. How often should businesses sit down with the employees and find out, you know, have they gotten another degree? Are they in school? Are they taking continuing education programs? What are they doing that is getting more skill development that the business could actually pull on and use? Because I know many times I would come into a company, they'd know what I had there, and then in 6 months they would completely forget that I came, you know, from one of their customers and had all the cost information and all this kind of stuff in my head. And it would have been an advantage to even talk about how does the customer look at this. So how do we get so that we're not deaf, dumb, and blind to the skills and talents our employees come in with and develop while they're there?
I really encourage the clients that I work with and other folks that I talk with to have semi-annual performance reviews. And you don't have to have but one maybe formal interview, a performance interview on a annual basis. But at 6 months, you definitely need to be talking to people and seeing not only where the goals are and how their performance is going, but things like setting up opportunities for the person to go take a class. And then now that they've taken the class, you basically circle up and you find out how it went.
Right.
What did they learn? What needs to be added to their employee file for a skill set? And on the employee side, they need to make sure that they're communicating back, hey, I really appreciated the class. Here's what I learned. Here's what I want to do next so I can build my skill set so I can be a potential supervisor down the road or whatever, you know, position would be next for them. The employee needs to make sure that they're continually communicating that they did go to the class and what they learned, and then the supervisor needs to follow up and make sure that they, you know, like I said, attended the class, find out what they learned, and then document that so that it doesn't fall through the cracks. That's very easy, something that happens all the time. People learn new skill sets and it's never been documented. Then they have a reorg and they don't realize that they don't have to go find somebody. They have somebody, you know, right around the corner that has that skill set, but nobody remembered that or knew it because it wasn't documented or talked about.
Well, and the dynamics, again, of generations. So we have, and I hate to say it, but kids coming out of high school or college that are so tied to their phones and their, you know, all their devices that they're constantly texting. They always want to be on the internet and tweeting and Facebooking and all this kind of stuff. How do we manage those new challenges of, let's say, the under 30s that want to be constantly plugged in and manage that performance? Not saying that, you know, you can't do this at work, but you really can't do this at work, right?
That's a good question, and once we figure that out, I definitely want to write a bestseller on that. I run into that quite a bit because you have, you know, oftentimes three generations, if not more, in your workplace, and every generation has a different work ethic and a different experiences. And you're right, the younger generation is very tied to their phones and their Facebook, and they oftentimes don't realize that they're not paid to do those things, that they're being paid to actually perform a job. And so supervisors and business owners across the board, whether you're a small business or a large business, are having to take additional steps to really basically train them how to be an employee. Here's what the expectations are. Here's what you can do. You're welcome to do this, you know, at a different time. We encourage you sometimes, you know, because that, you know, can be some great opportunities for marketing if they share what's going on.
And it can be really bad if the beer pictures show up, you know, connected to the company.
And help them see that that's a bad thing, that, you know, what they did in college is not necessarily transferable into their position now that they're, you know, working, that there is a difference and there are boundaries and whatnot. But it's definitely being very intentional to kind of groom them and help them develop into an employee, because they really oftentimes don't understand what the expectation level is and what is required of them and what steps they need to do to transition so that they do perform and they are contributing to the company, as well as doing some of the things that come very natural to them.
Well, I know I had my niece working for me, I think it was last summer, and because I want to instill that ethic of work for the extra things that you want. And she was scanning documents for me, and she was doing a good job, but I noticed I would go in and she would be on her phone. I said, well, I'm not paying you to be on your phone. She goes, well, it's scanning and it's processing. I said, yes, I know, but there's files to be labeled. You know, and that's different. I can do that with my niece working for me in my business and getting paid minimum wage. But, you know, it's those kind of dynamics that kids resent trying to be telling to put down the phone. Or, you know, I'm seeing the news stories where they're actually sitting there in the interview on their phones. And so what is this almost disconnect of behavior that we don't know when to put, or how to dress, when to put down the phones, what's appropriate to say or not say, what's good to put on your Facebook page, all those kind of things?
It's actually evolving, I think, as time goes on, because I can remember not when Facebook didn't even exist.
I'm just kidding.
So, you know, it's evolving. You know, each generation, they have access to more technology. When I was growing up, I mean, we had 3 channels on the television. That was it. And so you didn't have, you know, this plethora of
distractions
and different things that you could be doing. So it's definitely mentoring is going to become a bigger and bigger thing for not only big businesses, but also for smaller businesses. And to be able to help these folks, you know, the younger folks, realize that there is a time and a place for things. And, you know, a lot of it is just maturity, but a lot of it is the access to information that we didn't have 5 years ago. And so some of it is helping the older generation realize that there are different ways, that how we used to do things 20 years ago might still work, but it's maybe not the most effective or the most productive way to do it. So it's kind of a give and take on both sides, but definitely the mentoring opportunities. Because in mentoring, I've worked with CIS before, and oftentimes I learned as much as what I was actually trying to teach. And so that gives you a great opportunity for both sides to kind of take a peek into the world of the other and figure out how best can we work together and accomplish what we need to accomplish without having to be dictators and slap their hand and tell them to put it down, because that's just going to pretty much cause a, you know, a sort of a hostile work environment situation, and that's not going to help anybody.
Well, and one more quick question. We have like a minute left. How much can we as business people, when we're going out and we're going to screen people, not necessarily, not everybody's going to hire an HR person to help them screen the candidates. How much can we use Facebook and those kind of things and those internet searches in our hiring decisions without getting in trouble?
I would definitely use them with a filter of caution, that oftentimes, you know, people do post things not thinking how it's going to affect them in the future. So, you know, just because they have a couple pictures on the Facebook that are not necessarily what you would prefer doesn't necessarily mean that that's the type of person that they are on a regular basis. But definitely with the filter of caution, and I would still go through with background checks and face-to-face interviews and put more weight on those things than I would social media.
Well, thank you, Ann, for being on the show today. And
thank
your
you.
Website is?
www.closehrconnections, and that's with an S, .com. And I would love to hear from the listeners. And if you have a question about HR, be glad to answer it for you.
And we'll see you next week. And until then, stay focused on the important things.